Nicholson Baker's got a new book out. It's called Traveling Sprinkler. Any of you have a traveling sprinkler, by the way? In Gretna, they must have traveling.
Absolutely.
Yeah, do you have one in Gretna,
no, I don't.
Nebraska? I'm surprised. Do you have a neighbor who has? Have you seen them?
At antique shops.
Well, I think they still make them. We'll find out. Nicholson Baker knows all about them. And he's online with us now from Maine, South Berwick, I guess. Hi, Nicholson. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. This traveling sprinkler thing is kind of, I know it's a metaphor, isn't it? Got to be.
It's got to be a metaphor because it's a whole novel.
That's really stretching a metaphor, isn't it, an entire novel?
Well, I thought, you know, nobody has devoted a whole novel to a garden care implement.
But why the traveling sprinkler?
I don't know if you know what they look like.
I looked them up. They're nice.
Okay.
They're cool.
Yeah, well, my father bought a traveling sprinkler for me when I was about eight. We went to Sears, and there was this little tractor. It's a cast iron tractor, and you know, it was clear you hooked the hose in the back, and the thing swirled around, and there was a gear in the middle that moved two levers that pulled it forwards very slowly through the garden. And I thought, man, this is the most beautiful American invention I've ever seen. And my father bought it for me.
Yeah.
And when we moved to Maine, he gave me the ancestral traveling sprinkler. And it's been in our barn ever since. I've been sort of saving it up as the beginning of a book.
And you lay the hose out, and then it will travel its own hose, right, basically?
Yeah, and that's the beautiful thing about it, is that you set the root up in advance. So the hose, which is its source of power, becomes its history, really, becomes its future, I guess you could say.
Ah, is this where the metaphor comes in then?
Exactly. Yeah, right, exactly. Novelists, you know, set up a sort of a rough idea of where they want to go.
Yeah.
And then they go. And sometimes it doesn't work, and the traveling sprinkler gets off the hose.
Yeah. Well, I guess we've all had that happen. But
it was invented a long time ago.
Yeah.
1941 was when the design came in. This guy in North Platte, Nebraska, came up with this little tractor. And I just thought, wow, this is what... you know, American ingenuity is good at this kind of thing, and we should celebrate it and think about it.
It was, anyway. And then, is it possible to write a book without any garden metaphors?
Well, I've done it before. I mean, this is my 15th book. I started with the escalator because I thought that was the primal invention.
Right.
The first book I wrote was about a guy getting on the bottom at the bottom of an escalator, riding it up to the mezzanine, thinking about things, and he gets off at the top. So it's a travel book.
And Vox really is about just a telephone, really, right?
Very much about a telephone. Well, it's about two people at the end of different telephones.
Yeah.
And they get naked and talk about things.
Yeah. By the way, you've been accused of ruining pornography with that book. Do you want to respond to that? Yeah, actually, the man who ruined pornography for everybody. Nicholson.
Oh, God.
Baker.
Well, I felt that pornography was in a bad way. Literary pornography was all about talking about your pets in your house and your infidelities and all sorts of non-pornographic things. And I thought, why not devote an entire book to a kind of mutual seduction? Have it be one gigantic sex scene so that the things that were not dirty, we're actually more forbidden, you know.
Yeah.
When you started to talk about traffic lights, you weren't talking about sex, and so you were kind of transgressing.
Yeah, but I think it wasn't a complaint that the way they talked about sex made it totally sexless, because they went into details about it. You know, they did a Nicholson Baker, and went off with their sprinkler going down the hose line.
I thought it was sex. I was excited at the time I wrote it. What can I say?
And I guess Monica did give it to Bill. That's what I heard. Did you hear that?
She thought it was exciting.
Yeah.
But yes, she was. She gave her own copy to Bill Clinton, and that was one of the best things that's ever happened to me, really.
Yeah.
Of course, it wasn't something we want on the national news. We don't want married presidents doing strange things with interns. But
no.
But. The idea that she gave my book as a present to him was a great honor.
You and Leaves of Grass, you know, you and Whitman.
I forgot that.
Yeah.
That's right.
So that's cool.
Walt Whitman. Who does not rhyme?
No. And Paul Chowder, of course, in this book, this is the second Paul Chowder novel.
Right. I wrote a book back in 2009, which is about this guy who is living in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, fairly near where I live. He's got a barn. He's up in the barn singing a lot, trying to write an introduction to a collection of rhyming poetry, even though he himself is a non-rhyming poet, and it's becoming more and more difficult because he has to kind of be a master of ceremonies for all of the greatness of British and American poetry. He thinks about the depressive poets and their love lives and iambic pentameter and everything else.
Yeah.
And it has to, at some point, become a novel, and that's the trick.
Yeah. At some point in his life, being anthologized kind of ruined his life or something, didn't it?
Well, it wasn't necessarily I have a huge collection of poetry anthologies because I'm fascinated by the choices that people make. Mm-hmm. Why do you pick a certain poem? You know, when I read a poem in an anthology, I think, well, that is great. That particular line is great. But then three lines down, there's a terrible line. You know, and you have to put up with the terrible line.
Yeah.
As well as the good line. And Paul Chowder thinks about an anthology that would just be not of poems, but just of good lines from poems. And then he thinks, no, there's often an especially good word in a good line. And so that it would just be an anthology of a particular word in a particular line. So one word from each poem.
Right. And then he thinks about all kinds of things. I mean, that's what's interesting about Paul Chowder, and I suspect Nicholson Baker, is that he branches out and what are, to him, I guess, related discussions or interests, such as the sunken cathedral and so forth, and the bassoon.
The bassoon, right.
Yes.
Well, I was a bassoonist in high school, and I spent a year at the Eastman School of Music and, you know, practiced the bassoon so hard that I had to play it with my jaw dislocated slightly, and it pushed my two front teeth apart. You know, I was really devoted to this instrument. It's a beautiful, it's got a kind of suppressed, lyrical human sound to it, but it's very soft. It looks like it would make a lot of noise, but it doesn't. And I got a job as the fourth bassoonist at the Rochester Philharmonic, which means nobody ever heard me, but I had a white bow tie on.
Oh, you were the fourth. They had three ahead of you?
Yeah, there were three ahead of me.
It's a big bassoon section, isn't it, for an orchestra?
Well, right. So they would only hire me, and I was a member of the bassoonists' union, or I guess the musicians' union. So if there was a big Bruckner or Mahler symphony, then I was the guy. I came on.
Yeah. Why bassoon, though? I mean, when we were in school, most of us get a chance to pick an instrument, and you take a trumpet or, you know, drums or something like that. Why bassoon?
Well, I thought briefly about drums, but the thing about the bassoon is it looks so interesting. It's got these very, very long keys that are nickel-plated, and so you touch something with your left thumb. You control something like 12 keys with your left thumb, and they reach all over this thing. It's very Victorian, and it feels mechanical, and yet out of it comes something lyrical. I guess that's what appealed to me.
Yeah.
And then I heard Stravinsky's solo, the Firebird solo, which is just such a stunningly beautiful, simple melody. And I thought, man, I want to play that. I really, really want to be able to play that.
Mm-hmm. And yet Stravinsky was no Debussy.
Stravinsky was no Debussy. Okay, well, so the book, this book, Traveling Sprinkler, is really about my attempt to think about Stravinsky and Debussy, but also to be a reasonable, normal human being.
You know, what
we think about all sorts of things in our lives. Sometimes they're political grievances, and sometimes you think about Claude Debussy's Piano Preludes, and sometimes you make an egg salad sandwich. How do you balance all that in a novel?
Yeah, that's where the traveling sprinkler going around spraying all over the place, right? Basically?
Why not?
Even if on a track going down its history, all these things get sprayed all over.
Yes, and the trick is, how do you do that and not become tiresome?
Yeah. Have you figured that out yet or not?
Well, it's always risky. I mean, that's the experiment with every book. How close do you come to real life without becoming a mere transcriber and a kind of a retailer of the boring mundane. How do you become keep strangeness and surprise and even maybe a little humor in there at the same time you are telling, giving us the texture of what life is really, what life really feels like?
Yeah. It, and I love this this section on metaphorical interference. I loved it so much. I took it downstairs and read it to my wife, and this has never happened before. I mean, I tried a couple times. I read her things. She always gets them wrong, or doesn't think they're interesting or funny. But she even liked it.
That's incredibly.
Yeah.
You know that I first started listening to your show back when I was driving on Route 390 from a place in upstate New York called Mount Morris, where we were living. We called it Mount Misery. And I would drive north to Rochester, New York, and I heard this guy on the radio that was just so incredibly quick, who could just cut through all of the stuff and get to the little nugget of humor in what somebody had said. And I just thought, I can never do that. I'm so jealous.
Oh, no, but, well, I don't know if you do it. I think you do, but Paul Chowder, that's his whole life, isn't it? I mean, the conflict of metaphorical, you know, there are so many metaphors going on at the same time that they interfere with one another and tend to cancel one another out, right?
So say you've decided, okay, the traveling sprinkler is your central controlling metaphor, and then you also want to write about Debussy's Sunken Cathedral. Those things are so far apart mentally that they create a kind of interference pattern, a purple fringing kind of thing when they conflict.
Right.
And I decided in this book that I would empty myself and just put everything I had in the book and see and watch them conflict and accept the fact that, you know, that too many colors make the rinse water muddy, you know, in those glasses in grade school when you were doing watercolors. But that, so what? You have to risk muddiness sometimes.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's a tough one. By the way, isn't it actually the swallowed cathedral? Because I looked at isn't the French word for swallowed as opposed to sunken?
It's englouti.
Yeah.
La cathédrale englouti, which means submerged.
It does?
It just doesn't sound as good. If you talk about the submerged cathedral, it doesn't fit English as well as sunken cathedral.
Okay. So it's not swallowed, because I thought I had something there because I looked it up. And...
Well, I mean, swallowed would be good, too, because...
Yeah.
Debussy was really, he was, okay, let me tell you about Debussy. He was a guy with a huge forehead.
Oh.
The music was all in his forehead. He looked like a banker in a way. He's this brilliant guy who could noodle around for hours, and then he ran into money worries. He married a person he thought she had money, but her father disinherited her. And then he thought, what am I actually going to do that is of value here? And she wrote these 12 piano preludes that just, and the 10th of them is called the Sunken Cathedral. And it's an incredible piece of music. It's my favorite piece of classical music. It's why I wanted to become a classical composer.
Huh.
It evokes this sense of kind of floating through blue but somewhat misty, indistinct water and seeing a medieval ruin kind of hovering closer to you, and the fishes are swimming down the nave, and it's, you know, there's seaweeds around. It's just an amazing piece of music, an evocation.
Yeah, I listened to it.
What did you think?
It starts slow, but it builds.
Well, it's got a good beat.
No, I liked it a lot. And it's unique, it seems to me. I've never heard anything quite like it.
What he did was he used this, you know, there's those three pedals. When I was a kid, I used to arrange my army men around the underneath the grand piano. My friend had a grand piano, and we would set up these army kind of conflicts near the pedals of the grand piano. So the pedals were always crucial, and there are three of them, and you feel as if you're driving something when you're playing the piano. You know, if you hold the sustain pedal down, you're going somewhere.
Was he holding all three for this prelude, or...?
I think he was holding two of them down, softness. But, and he also did this other thing that was interesting. You know how grand pianos can open up sort of like cicadas or something? They open up one wing. But he put the top of the piano down so that it would muffle the sound.
Yeah.
He was very edgy and ahead of his time.
Yeah. And Stravinsky was sort of the opposite. Was that right?
Stravinsky was from Russia. He was a very ambitious younger composer. He learned lots of harmonic tricks from Debussy. And then he wrote this thing called The Rite of Spring, which is important to all bassoonists because it begins with this gigantic... Very, very seldom that a bassoon gets to start anything, gets to start a whole orchestra going. And The Rite of Spring is sort of the adolescent male fantasy of what music could possibly be. The whole orchestra is a giant percussion section. But it starts with this very plaintive Russian kind of folk melody on the bassoon. Really, just very simple, but in the high register. So he's sort of torturing the bassoon. He's saying, you know, you're going to try to sound like a flute, but you're not a flute. You're just this anonymous person struggling and, you know, leaking air around the reed and doing the best you can do.
You're not a flute. Did you ever think about going to the flute? Probably a little easier than the bassoon.
The flute is made of metal. It's too understandable. I felt that the bassoon had more reach. Also, flutists were better musicians than I was.
Oh, okay. And it wasn't as competitive in bassoon?
I mean, look, if you look at the hierarchy of piano and violin is at the top, and then you move down through the stratum of the orchestra. You can be a trombonist, and below the trombonist are the bassoonists. Not to say that there aren't really great, brilliant, beautiful, genius bassoonists, but...
Yeah, or trombonists, for that matter.
Or trombonists.
Yeah, it's got to be. But somewhere.
You can make a mark as a bassoonist. You can make a mark when you wouldn't have even been a contender as a violinist.
Yeah. Now, writers and poets and so forth now, that end of things. This particular one, Paul Chowder, is at the point in his writing history where he needs a new drug to write. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I needed a new drug to write.
Oh, okay. This is not about you, though, is it? I mean, come on, this is a...
Well, everybody always pretends. You know, fiction writers always want to make it sound as if it's all fiction, but let's be real, it's not all fiction. It's 87% fiction, and then you arrange things, you know.
Yeah.
But I went to a cigar store in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where this book is set, and said, listen, I need to finish a book, and I want something really powerful. And he said, oh, you want something robust, and he took me into the... He took me into the secret chamber of cigar boxes, which is all carefully humidified and special air circulation. It's like a bookstore. It's like a rare book room of cigars. And he said, now how strong do you want it? And I said, I want it to just knock me on upside the head and mop the floor with me. I need something really powerful because I need to finish this book and it's hard. And he said, you need a Fausto cigar.
Fausto.
Fausto. Can you believe that name?
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, and it has a red label, and I bought a bunch of them, and I wrote the entire book sitting in my green Kia Rio. It's about a 10-year-old car. Smoking these things, and it was really a revelation how amazingly powerful tobacco can be.
Did you start with Skoal, though, as in the book?
Yeah, I thought, well, I don't want to be a smoker, so I bought a can of Skoal tobacco and stuff. A massive wedge of that in my mouth, and then I was the next thing I knew, I was lying on the grass, kind of moaning and retching. That talk about a powerful drug. That is too powerful.
Skoal.
That's for the Marines, you know.
Yeah. And but the pipe thing didn't work for you?
The pipe was a lot of work. You had to stuff things in. You bought this thing that looked like a nail and stuff the tobacco in. It was a lot of work to light it. I burned my thumb trying to light it, so... But a cigar is a very simple thing. That's stuff grown in Nicaragua, and it's wrapped with leaves of tobacco grown in Connecticut, which I had no idea. There's a whole culture of cigars. Not to say that anyone should smoke them, but you know, for as a temporary expedient, it's not bad.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the other thing I like, there's many things I like about this book, but I really like the Quaker meetings and the idea of not saying too much. At a Quaker, or knowing what to say at a Quaker when you feel like getting up to speak.
Yeah, so I'm not a... my mother's family was Quaker, but I never was... I was raised as a kind of non-theist person. I don't have a godly side, I guess. It's too much in evidence. But I started going to these Quaker meetings and realizing that the silence was powerful, and it was... I was sitting amidst these good people who were trying to think their best thoughts, and the idea with Quaker meeting, there's nothing... You don't... Nothing. There's no part of it that's programmed. There's no singing. There's no person who's in charge, really. It just happens, and so anyone can say anything. And the only bit of etiquette is that you're not supposed to pop up right after somebody else has said something. You're supposed to let the silence work.
Yeah. You can't hitchhike on that. I like to hitchhike on that remark.
Yeah. You can't come up and say, and another thing, and just pop right in. It's wrong to do that. But the idea is to be unprepared and to think of the fragmentary idea that somebody has said, possibly. Say it, the things that hour long. So say somebody, there's been 20 minutes of silence, and somebody finally says something at 10 minutes to 11. Well, at about 12:03, the idea, whatever thoughts that person has had, have kind of caromed around the room, and then somebody else can stand up and say something that somehow has developed from that earlier incomplete idea. Mm. It's a very collaborative thing, and it actually is, well, it's helpful to me as a writer, but it's also just, it just helps me think, give me the illusion that I'm becoming a better human being, I guess.
Yeah, it's really nice. And what was it Paul Chowder finally got up to say? He had a rather elaborate thing he'd been saving and finally got to say it.
Well, right. I wanted to say something. I tried to say something about the sunken cathedral, because after all, that's what you, when you're a novelist, you get to write down and actually groom a little bit the things you didn't say in Quaker mm-hmm. meeting. So I suppressed it for a while.
No, not you. Paul Chowder.
I'm sorry. Yes. We want to make the distinction. I mean, the difference between Paul Chowder and me is that I live in Maine, and I am happily married, and I have two grown children. He is sort of my alter ego if he had never met the person that is my wife. This is what my life would be like. I'd be kind of more of a lost soul trying to figure things out without any help, and it would be a very bad situation. But anyway, he stands up and talks about... Paul McCartney's Blackbird song, I think, at the end.
Yeah, that was very nice, too. He also has very eclectic taste in music, if nothing else.
Well, I do, because I find that when I'm writing, I sometimes need to hear really thumping trance music in the headphones, mm-hmm. as loud as possible. The loudness of the music distracts me from the fact that the writing of the day before maybe wasn't so good.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. And the character here, Paul Chowder, actually in this book sets out not to write a poem, but to write a song, and hopefully a protest song. With a funkadelic dance beat.
Exactly.
Yes.
Why not? We all have political feelings. This was written during an election period, and there was it was just constant. And I thought, let politics into this book, because you're trying to tell the truth about life. So how do you react when you've read a piece of upsetting news? You can write a letter to the editor or write essays. I've tried to write books that were somewhat political. Mm-hmm. They only go so far, and I needed help. So the help of harmony and melody what I thought was, okay, maybe you won't agree with my political opinions. They are a little bit out there. I'm a pacifist. I don't think that exploding things on people's heads in distant countries with unmanned vehicles is a good idea in any way. But I can sing about that, and I'll have the help of some nice chords.
Yeah.
That was the idea. So I finished 12 songs as I was writing the book, or maybe I finished them a little bit after I wrote the book. But so the 12 songs are available on the ebook, and you can see whether Paul Chowder, you know, has any talent or not.
Oh, now it's Paul Chowder. When it comes to the critics, it's Paul Chowder.
You Yeah, you have to make your... The great thing about being a novelist is you can make your little scenes and set off your little explosions and then run away and say it was all in character.
Yeah, all in character. Well, Traveling Sprinkler is the name of the novel, and it's you definitely should read it. It's a great one. And Nicholson, it was delightful speaking to you.
Thank you, Michael. Take care.
Very nice. Nicholson Baker, ladies and gentlemen. Traveling Sprinkler is the book.